What's up, Sid?
How are you, Felix?
Good, good. Well, glad to have you in Miami finally for a couple of days. And we're making this sit down happen. For the quick introduction, I'm here with Sid Powell, the founder and CEO of Maple Finance, one of the leading real-world asset lending protocols. I've listened to all your podcasts now, so I can make this the most exciting podcast episode of you. You like to liken it to like the Shopify of credit markets, where you're not the lender or the borrower. You're simply a platform that enables anybody to either be a lender, a borrower, a pool manager, and really, I guess, democratize the lending market and also make it from this really closed door ecosystem, this closed door industry, to something that really anybody can access.
Yeah, I'd say that's a fair fair summary of how it works. So what we try to do with Maple is, as you said, we wanted to build more of like the Shopify. So I came from a banking background myself, working in like securitization, debt capital markets, before transitioning to going client side, working at a commercial leasing company. But my experience there was, you know, that was using the balance sheet to, you know, to originate loans.
Yeah.
Whereas what we wanted to do with Maple was create infrastructure that would allow someone to run a lending business or a credit fund, but do so on chain. And we're providing the infrastructure that facilitates that. So in the same way that Shopify is not an e-commerce retailer itself, they're just providing the infrastructure so that other people can run that business. That's what we're doing, but for lending businesses. So we give you with Maple the tooling that you need to pool capital, originate loans, collect repayments, pass those back through to LPs or depositors in your pool. And that's kind of the end-to-end operations of running a lending business, but just all done with as much automation as possible and, you know, leveraging the technology that's available with the blockchain.
Awesome. Before we nerd out on the real nitty gritty way how it works, let's take a step back and kind of like, I want to know like how your journey to crypto happened, because I know Maple started in about October 2020, right? So, you know, this is post DeFi summer. You know, I started crypto 16, 17. I thought I was late. People starting today think they were late. But in reality, so much new things are happening. And you guys were one of the few that kind of brought a whole new angle to DeFi. So let's maybe take it back. You graduated college in 2013 and started at the National Australia Bank. So maybe you can, I got your whole background here. I got you.
You've done your homework. I graduated college, university, end of 2013, went to work at National Australia Bank in Melbourne. And then I began in the credit risk and in the debt capital market space. So where I spent most of my time in banking was in a team called securitization. And so what that product is helping lending companies who don't take deposits. So a company that is, it might be, you know, it's called shadow banking sector, or non-bank lending sector. But either way, the differentiating factor is that you're not taking customer deposits in. So these were companies that would borrow from banks, or they would borrow through debt capital markets, and they would use that to then give themselves the funding to originate loans, home loans, car loans, that kind of thing. And so I cut my teeth in banking there, worked there for a couple of years. And then I actually always wanted to know what it was like to kind of run a business and learn how to run a business. So I went from deal side, which is, you know, you're banking, you do advisory, you do structuring, you originate deals, to go client side, which was a commercial leasing company.
Angle finance, right?
Yes. So,
and who was on the other side of those loans when you made it with National Australia Bank? Was it like businesses, individuals, like?
It was corporate. So corporate, it was an institution. So our clients were institutions. So it would be the company that does home loans. They would borrow from us, and then you would have this thing called a warehouse structure. So think of this like a really, really large pool that you fill with loans. And when it gets near the top, what you do is you do term out, or you do a debt capital markets transaction, where you're effectively then selling asset-backed bonds or asset-backed securities to institutional investors who would be insurance companies, other banks, other asset managers. And so effectively they are providing the finance or they are lending to this lending business. And so that lending business might borrow from them at 3 or 4%, and then it lends out at 5, 6, 7, 8, 9%, and then it collects, you know, the its profit margin, is the net interest margin in between, and that funds losses, operations, you know, all the other aspects of running a business.
And what did that process look like? Since, you know, we're going to get to the DeFi aspect in a moment where, you know, whether it's something like Aave, where it just takes a few clicks, with you guys, it is uncollateralized. So there's a little bit more filtering happening.
Yeah.
How did that filtering process look like? You know, this is 10 years ago, roughly, for, you know, traditional banks.
It's a very manual project. Mm-hmm. So it involves a number of different people, both internal and external to the bank. So we're on the structuring and advisory side. So this meant that we would put together the concept of a transaction. So you're going to borrow through an SPV. Here's the investors that you would target and issue those, you know, asset-backed securities to. And then we would kind of project manage or coordinate operations within the bank. And so this includes actually getting the money from either the bank or the investors to the lending company. We would also manage trustee, custodian, security trustee. So there's all these external parties that their fees feed into the cost structure of running that lending business. And financing cost is the biggest, that's effectively the gross cost of running a lending business. And so we would coordinate that as well as legal. Like there's a very heavy legal work stream, which involves doing hundreds of pages of legal documents for each of those transactions. And then you have a sales team that then sells the debt out to the institutional investing market. So
was the technology used in any part of that stack?
Very little.
Okay.
So you have the bank's core banking system. Yep. This would be used if you're just doing a bilateral loan. So we used to do like a warehouse facility, and this could be several hundred million up to like a billion for one of these lending companies. So that would be just on the bank's own private ledger, effectively. Or you could do, if you're terming out to the debt markets, you would have securities that have an ISIN number, and this means that it's being recorded with an external party. So that's where there is some technology involved, and that's like a registry that is capturing who owns what.
Got it. Okay, so up next you went to Angle Finance because you said you wanted to go from, the B2B to C to more, and like I guess bank to business to customer, right, with the warehousing to now the customer-facing side.
Yeah, so When I was on the bank, I thought I knew how one of those businesses ran. And then you go and you put your operator hat on. And so I went to work at the treasury at one of these commercial leasing companies. And this means you're then pulling together the reports. So the nice shiny spreadsheet that you get once a month as a bank when you're lending to these, you know, to these clients, you see how that gets put together. And so that's pulling from that company's information systems. You have to design the reporting. You have to specify what, you know, what goes into those reports, getting very familiar with the technology. You also have to understand how they implement and execute their credit policy. So this is how they decide who should be an eligible borrower for them, as well as how they do collection. So this is when somebody stops repaying, like maybe a small business, has an inventory issue, or they are a seasonal business and businesses slow during winter or during summer and they fall behind on payments. So then you've got a collections team that's going to reach out, start calling them going, you know, hey, like what's happening with your business? When can you repay or putting them on a payment plan? So you get familiar with that because you're having to communicate all of those aspects of the business to a bank, to try and get a loan for that company. So you come to know the technology, how they originate credit, how they service loans regularly. Like, do they have to call customers to get payments? Do customers do direct debit through a bank account, or are they going to a portal to pay? And so you get a very good idea of all of the technology that's involved. And then you have to coordinate the financing, you know, the financing side of that business, which is, do you have a trustee involved that you have to provide reporting to and, send payments to? So when you switch all of this business across to working on a blockchain, you take away all of those elements. Previously, you would send you're manually transmitting payments from a bank to a third party. They're calculating it, matching it up against a spreadsheet. Then they're sending it back to, you know, investors.
Yep.
And so there's a lot of manual human intervention steps in that process, which all get abstracted away when you start to run a lending business on chain.
And since you've sat in both, you had both shoes on, you sat on both sides of the aisle, which side did you have more frustrations with? So for example, when you were a bank, when you were representing the bank, did you have more frustrations with, you know, the warehousing that the companies that borrowed from you to then lend it out? Or on the flip side, when you now had to work with banks, like which one would you say need more work? Where was the more friction issues?
It's a good question. I mean, you always have friction, which is outwardly facing from whatever position you're in. So when I was at the bank, you know, the angst or the agitation was, why can't we get the reporting faster? Why are there errors with the reporting? What's going on with their business? Because you're focused on getting the transactions done.
Yeah.
And you also don't see how the sausage is made on the other side of that business. So you don't see how the reporting is put together. You know, why does it take three extra days to get this report versus, you know, why can't you just press a button and it's, you know, and it's a nice downloadable CSV for me. But that reflected my lack of understanding of how those businesses worked. So it's one thing to due diligence them and get all of your information on how that business runs from third hand, you know, or second hand from talking to them. It's another to then go onto that, you know, to go and step into their shoes and then see the challenges they might have with technology, like two systems that don't necessarily talk to each other. So instead, what you have to do is take them, you know, do a download or an extract from each of them and then match it up in a spreadsheet. Those are all manual elements of seeing how the sausage is made at that business. And you see that the, it's kind of like, I actually bring this up sometimes in crypto. There is the map of how a crypto business or startup works, which is often legible on Twitter, but doesn't give you the nuance of what's actually going on at that business. Which is, you know, the day-to-day recruitment, business development, managing HR issues, setting goals and OKRs for your team, and, you know, and developing the product and the technology stack.
Yeah.
Versus just people commenting on APYs or TVL or tokens on Twitter. That's kind of the...
Which long-term are kind of irrelevant.
Yeah, yeah. But in the short term, people zoom in on that aspect of the business because it's the most legible, but it's not necessarily the most important. And so when I was on the banking side, I was focused on what was legible about those businesses. But when I was actually at the business, I could see what was important, which was how do your technology systems talk to each other? You know, what is your collections process? How many days might a payment be late before your people are on the phone talking to them? What segments of the market do you actually target? Because when you're at a bank, you just see broad numbers, like what was new loans originated during the month. But loans have different probabilities of default, different levels of probability, different levels of profitability. And there's a whole segment or different segments of customers that each lending company could be going after. You know, when you get inside the business, you could see, are they trying to lend to the self-employed? You know, this might be tradespeople or small business owners, or are they lending to PAYG employees of large corporates? Like each of these will dictate how, you know, the long-term success of that business. And I see that now in crypto, the analogy is that somebody might say, well, Maple's in lending, Aave is in lending, Compound is in lending, but actually we're all targeting very different segments of the market. And so the product gets constructed in different ways to favor each of those segments.
So maybe you can pick it up there. And so you left the last gig in 2020 to start Maple in October. Maybe you can give a little bit of highlight of like, what did the landscape look like both in DeFi, because this is post-DeFi seminar, we had Aave, we had Compound, and also into the traditional world. I know you sometimes mention this on other podcasts, but also funny enough, I was a user of Lending Club, for example. I was actually like underwriting loans already back in when I was in college. This is like 2013 or so, maybe, you know, or 2015. So like, how does it come, like what was available from like, you know, the Lending Clubs? I think Prosper was another one. And then you have, you know, Aave, Compound, Maker.
Yeah.
Free Maple.
So pre-Maple, that landscape looked like the syndication of loans. So every individual loan would be treated as a different deal or a different transaction, call it. And so it led to a lot of uncertainty. And I'm going to jump around a little bit here. But you're a borrower. You want to borrow $100,000 to finance inventory or some other aspect of your business. You have to go to Lending Club or to Prosper. You have to put out that request for a loan, submit information about yourself. But then you have to find... maybe it's 20, maybe it's 10, maybe it's 50 different people who want to syndicate and participate and fund your loan. So you don't know what price you need to offer to clear. You also don't know when you're going to get responses back. And there's a lot of uncertainty in that process as a business owner when you just want to Really, you just want to have one point of contact, mm-hmm. talk to them, provide all your information privately, get an indicative idea of pricing, get an indicative idea of when you can have finance. Mm-hmm. And all of that was lost when you had to syndicate every individual loan. Mm. So that's one aspect of the business, which I think was unsatisfactory to borrowers, versus what Maple does, just to contrast that aspect, mm-hmm. is more the syndication of like a credit fund or a syndication of a lending balance sheet. Mm-hmm. So Maple has, we call them a delegate. They're managing effectively an on-chain balance sheet or an on-chain lending business, an on-chain credit fund, however you want to characterize it. What they're doing is they're syndicating that pool. And mm-hmm. so people are depositing into that pool, but it means they end up with a war chest of maybe 100, maybe $200 or $300 million. And so if you're a borrower, you go to them and you get certainty. They can quote you a price. They can say it's going to be subject to their completion of due diligence. You're not relying on 20 people individually duplicating an assessment of your business from a credit risk perspective.
Now, that kind of brings it back to like the original model when you worked at the bank, where like this is kind of like the warehousing now, no? Mm. Because you have, the company, you're lending to the company who will then lend to individuals.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Now, that does introduce two things. One, perhaps a little bit more centralization. Again, like, you know, it's not trustless, but like it is, you do have to trust third parties. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because we had a 40-minute segment with Ari when he was on the podcast, and you know Ari loves real-world lending, so we geeked out about this. And something I brought up is that to some degree, you have really two options. Either one, you have individual underwriters, which was kind of the problem with Lending Club, where, for example, like I had to say, like, this guy wants $25, like, you know, you make even small amounts, right? Somebody wants to fix up their house. Somebody wants to go on vacation. Somebody wants like to invest in their company. And you have such limited information, so does the average person know really well how to allocate? Probably not. Which reminds me also of like equity crowdfunding, right? A lot of like some of the lowest caliber of companies do equity crowdfunding. Why? Because, you know, the average Joe doesn't really know how to read disclosures, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of tricky to expand this market to the average Joe. Now, on the flip side, you can have, in your case, you know, the pool managers, mm-hmm. right? But with pool managers, you're now again trusting that they do it well. How do you balance, like, I guess in your mind, because I'm sure you thought about all these different models, how do you balance, I guess, that self-sovereignty that people can, you know, underwrite individual deals and not having to rely on trusted third parties, but at the same time, making sure that the investor is protected?
Mm. It's a good question. And we arrived at that, you know, the syndication of the pool and the use of a pool delegate as effectively an outsourced credit underwriter or, you know, outsourced lending business.
Yeah.
Through some trial and error, when we began, it was, you know, mid 2018. We were investigating how smart contracts worked, and we're looking at any indications of early TradFi instruments, whether it was like ISDAs or futures or forward rate agreements that were being done with smart contracts. We couldn't see much that was being done in the lending space, so I read all the white papers in 2018. Then early 2019, put together a concept for effectively securitization on chain. So you would have tranche senior tokens, mezz tokens, junior tokens, and you would need a basket of yield generating assets to supply the yield that you would tranche out. Mm-hmm. But that didn't exist at the time. So that was very, very early DeFi. That was Compound V1 was maybe just out at that time. And so we couldn't find the ecosystem wasn't developed enough for our product to succeed because you didn't have widespread originations being done on chain such that you could offer, you know, tranching so that you could give people a lower rate that had a lot of credit protection built in.
Right.
Nobody wanted that.
There's a number of products like Barnbridge, 18MPH, but there was no Pendle.
Ondo, Pendle. Yeah. There's quite a few now that do it. It's probably about
virtually no demand. Yeah.
But you were limited. So we said, okay, we're going to have to go upmarket or upstream. Mm-hmm. So we said, we'll create the lending assets that will supply the yield to that we can then tranche out. Mm-hmm. And so we looked at peer-to-peer lending being done on chain, and it was called, you know, uncollateralized or under-collateralized lending. Mm-hmm. What we did was this idea of small communities that could originate loans, but it was closer to the lending club model because each loan had to be syndicated. So you put out a request and then multiple people might fund it. And so we built a proof of concept. We hired a developer to do this. Mm-hmm. And then we did all the product management, all the wireframes for how this would work. And we found it was a difficult market to crack because the loan sizes were smaller.
Yeah.
The people were riskier. You're underwriting somebody. And on the retail lending side, if you ever do that, your biggest risks of default are things like divorce, illness, loss of job. Mm. So it's not something where you can form a predictable view subscale unless you're doing hundreds or thousands of people.
Right.
And then the margins were too small relative to your probability of default. So we did a few loans. We were just doing this with our savings. And we got to maybe, you know, 40, 50,000 worth of loans. And we're trying to work out how to do this and how to scale it. And the problems were it's risky. It's our balance sheet. Retail lending is heavily regulated. And you can't justify the fee. So it might take you still 10 hours cumulatively of analysis to underwrite one of these borrowers versus a corporate borrower. But because the loan size is 1% of what you might do, it might be a $5,000 or $10,000 loan. Mm-hmm. There's not enough fees to pay you for the time and turn it into a scalable business.
Right.
Plus your probability of default was going to be naturally higher versus institutions. So mid-2020, you know, May, June 2020, we're kind of in the wilderness thinking, retailer this business model. And then by this stage, DeFi summer is starting to take off. So you see comp, yield farming. People are very enamored with the idea of pools, AMMs. Yep. And so we combined the concept of lending. We decided we still wanted to be masters of our own destiny.
Yep.
And this meant we had to control the vertical stack, which meant lending originations. But we would combine this with the concept of pooling so that we're not syndicating each loan because that was just so time consuming. And it meant that borrowers are getting a bad experience because they would put out a request and they're like waiting for it to be funded. And we had the same issue because we would try out Dharma, which was doing peer-to-peer lending at the time.
Yeah, I remember them. They were one of the first DeFi protocols. I don't know what happened to them. Did they get acquired?
They did get acquired. Yeah. So they pivoted to be a wallet and then they got acquired as the wallet product. But I remember creating a request for $500 and then creating a ticket to lend $500. Yep. And I was waiting to see how long they would get matched. And it took weeks, and I don't think it ever actually got matched. So I was kind of like, well, how do you make this business work?
Yeah.
And so we hit on the idea of pooling, where you'd have the capital goes in, and it goes in on a presumption that it's going to be lent in a certain strategy with a certain price range and a certain acceptable risk tolerance and this industry. You know, similar to what we did when I was in securitization. Sometimes we would pre-fund an SPV, and this would mean putting in $200 million of funding. And then the lending company can go and take that and just start originating loans. Mm-hmm. Whereas normally they would be loans that already exist and you evaluate their credit risk and then you're buying them at an advance rate. But anyway, getting back to we got from Maple Loans to then we reintroduced the concept of pooling.
Yep.
And then we had two tranches. So we kept it simple. We just said, we'll do senior, we'll do junior. Junior will provide like a reserve for first loss capital and we'll have an outsourced manager so that we can scale it without having to just keep hiring credit analysts. And that manager, the delegate, will have to put in some of their own capital in the subordinated reserve. Mm-hmm. And this will help align their incentives or give them skin in the game so that they are, you know, paying attention to credit risk management. You didn't want to end up with a countrywide financial situation, which was the lending company during the GFC, where they just originate and they sell 100 cents of the dollar of those loans off their own balance sheet. And so they remove all their own credit risk. So they originate faulty loans and then they sell them to somebody else. Yeah. Somebody else gets left holding the bag. We didn't want that.
How do you guys currently break down the value accrual? Because you have now, I guess, I would say four different parties that want to profit off it. You've got on one hand, the protocol needs to make some money for maintenance. When I say protocol, I mean, let's say that the people building it, the salespeople and so forth.
Yeah.
Then you've got the token holders, and then you have the pool manager, and then the lenders to that pool. What's kind of like the value split amongst those?
So the operations of the protocol depend on having lenders, the delegate who is making the credit underwriting decisions, but they're interesting because they're not doing it in a custodial way. So it's not like the lenders deposit money with the delegate and then the delegate takes it and can do whatever they want with it. Mm-hmm. They're really just approving loans out of their pool and taking a cut of it. But the pool's always non-custodial. So that means they can't freeze withdrawals. They can't, you know, deploy it in hedge fund-like strategies or trading strategies. It's always just going for a pure play lending
business line. Which is that's one of the main benefits of you guys doing this on-chain.
So if you contrast this with CeFi lenders, you are giving an unsecured loan to a CeFi lender. You're taking their counterparty risk, and then they are on lending it to other people how they see fit, or they might be deploying it in trading strategies, DeFi yield strategies, and you know other things of that nature. But it's a black box.
A lot of opacity. You have no idea what's happening.
Yeah, really very, with your money. Very, very opaque. Whereas here, and so you're. If you're depositing with them, you were kind of commingled with all of those business risks. So if something blew up in one part of that business, then it would impact your deposits, even if your deposits have been used elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, you're depositing into a pool, and it's just a pure play lending business. And there's it's not commingled, so it's not if you deposit into a pool that's managed by, let's say, you know, Genesis or BlockFi or Celsius yeah. or any one of these CeFi lenders, it's not commingled with their other business activities. It's only going to fund loans out of that
that they approve,
that they approve out of that pool.
Yeah.
And then when the money gets repaid from those loans, it can't be frozen. You can withdraw it, you know, just by interacting with a smart contract. So you're just effectively redeeming your, you know, your LP token. So that is, I think, one of the clear benefits of using DeFi rails
yep.
over the kind of the black box of CeFi. But just, yeah, so coming back to kind of the participants in the protocol.
Yep.
So you have lenders. Lenders are getting passed through from interest.
Yep.
They are bearing credit risk. Yeah, the delegates. Delegates are putting their own skin in the game, and they are applying their underwriting expertise, and they're servicing the loan book.
Is there a minimum to become a delegator?
Yeah, so we've had... The delegates put, you know, put some money in the reserve cover,
mm-hmm.
and this has until now been comprised of MPL tokens. So they had to buy the MPL tokens to do that, as well as USDC, and we had a hard coded minimum at a smart contract level. Mm-hmm. But then we've seen that all the delegates have put in more than $1 million, so that it's a meaningful amount
mm-hmm.
For you know to ensure that they adhere to good underwriting standards.
And is it something that gets slashed if they?
It does. If they write bad loans, then cover gets liquidated,
mm-hmm.
and the limitations were that cover is liquidated through a balancer pool. So it was mm-hmm. liquidated through an AMM. So you have the limitation of how much you could push, you know, withdraw from a balancer pool at one point in time,
mm-hmm.
and so, but ultimately, conceptually, the delegate is getting slashed.
Got it. Although, I mean, it's a natural part of business that at some point they're going to write a bad loan. Like, not everybody's going to repay.
Yeah.
So how do you balance that?
Through the pricing of risk.
Mm-hmm.
So the delegate should be writing loans with an interest rate such that, assuming a reasonable amount of defaults,
mm-hmm.
so let's say that might be like 1% to 3% in mm-hmm. kind of the corporate and institutional banking space, mm-hmm. then they're currently writing loans at, you know, 9 to 12%.
Mm-hmm.
So net of 1% to 3% deposits, defaults, you're still clearing, you know, a 7% to 9% or 7% to 10% net yield.
So if it falls below that, that's when they start getting slashed.
No, they still get slashed on any liquidation that occurs.
Okay.
So it's kind of it's almost like a proof of stake type mechanism where the requirement to be a validator on the network delegate is that you deposit. is that you deposit into that cover reserve,
mm-hmm.
and then if you write bad loans, you're not adhering to your SLAs, and you get slashed. Conceptually, that's good.
That's good checks and balances.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So you've got the lenders. They the pass through of the interest minus what the delegator takes. Does the delegate does the delegator set it himself, or is this predetermined by the protocol?
So there's a portion that's predetermined by the protocol, mm-hmm. which goes to the treasury, and so this is like a platform fee. So.
Yep.
It costs money to operate the protocol, to set up, to run it, to develop it. So there is a fee that goes to the protocol to maintain that up,
mm-hmm.
you know, maintain that uptime and continuous development. And this is an origination fee paid by the borrower. So 67 basis points mm-hmm. of origination volume will go to the treasury. And then 33 basis points will go to the delegate for the time going into structuring and doing the deals. And then the delegate will keep, by default, 10% of the interest.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not 10 of 11%, but this is, let's say the delegate writes a loan at 12%, they're going to keep 1.2% of that.
Right.
So, you know, $100 of interest comes through, they'll, by default, keep $10 mm-hmm. off that. And then in the existing pools, we had $10 was going to cover as well to incentivize people to go, you know, to deposit to cover.
Mm-hmm.
What we'll be moving to in future is just...
Do you say 10%?
Yeah, 10%.
Gotcha. Yeah. So then the lender gets 80.
Lender gets 80.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So $80 of every $100 paid in interest.
Mm-hmm.
But that can be set by the delegate because remember, each different industry vertical that they could be lending to could be a different credit risk or it could be a different level of complexity. If you're lending to Bitcoin miners versus market makers, that requires more upfront credit assessment, maybe a site visit.
Mm-hmm.
There's just more involved, and so maybe you charge a higher interest rate, and the delegates charge a higher portion of that as their fee for managing it.
Right, because there's more work involved where, like you said, on-site visits and so forth, even checking like the hardware, if it's resellable, what's the actual equity value of the company and so forth.
But in principle, it reflects the design principle that what we're kind of designing for is for the lending company or the delegate to manage a pool that can be customized, you know, to some degree. So you don't want everything to be totally customizable. Mm-hmm. But you want some degrees of freedom so that they can target different risk levels. Like if we said across the board, it's only ever allowed to be 10% and this is set at a protocol level, then that would severely restrict the universe that Maple can cater to.
Plus, you know, as you said in the beginning, your goal is to be a platform, right?
Exactly.
So if ultimately what you really rely on here is that either existing businesses start using you, or I'm sure there will be entire new businesses that will be, that's both sprung up that utilize, you know, Maple as their core infrastructure for like entire whole, you know, loan origination businesses.
Exactly. One of the ways I think about it is you had things like Patreon, Shopify, Substack, were all businesses or platforms that allowed you to disaggregate or unbundle yourself from a larger collective where you were effectively contributing 3x what you're getting paid or 4x what you're getting paid. And it allowed you to monetize your own expertise. So Patreon, do podcasts or other publications. Substack, you do publications. Really well-known examples coming out of that were things like Stratechery, where you had a very successful writer who was otherwise kind of part of a larger organization where they were subsidizing the poorer quality writers. Same with Shopify. So a platform which enabled you to run a business and kind of monetize your expertise. What Maple is doing is in that same vein where I think longer term, what this does is it increases the supply side of middle market lending. So you have previously you had people who might have been very good credit underwriters at Fortress Group, or maybe they're at JP Morgan. And so they're getting paid a salary, but they're not really monetizing that P&L that they're bringing to the bank. And they're doing that because they don't have a tech stack that they can actually use. Like if you wanted to do a lending business, well, you're going to start by running it out of a spreadsheet. But and you have to set up bank accounts. And so it's a huge fixed cost investment. Whereas with Maple, that fixed cost gets significantly compressed. And so the cost of starting up a lending business or a credit fund is so drastically reduced that more people will be encouraged to do it, and they will fork off or unbundle themselves from the structuring desks and the debt capital markets teams of, you know, JP Morgan, other large commercial banks, maybe some of the credit funds. And so I think you'll see more, like, the market structure will evolve to be more smaller players.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, look, it's funny. In one of the podcasts, you mentioned that how a lot of technologies actually grow a market, right? And so, for example, many years ago, people would laugh at people doing YouTube, right? Now, being a social media influencer is an entire career path for a lot of people, right? Now, similarly, I can totally see that, you know, every small town can have a guy that just really knows the local businesses, knows who they can loan to, right? And those are people that would probably not have an easy time getting access to capital. But if you... You pretty much would be able to, for example, invest into, you know, lending to small businesses in any part of America, any part of the world, really, by funneling through these, I guess, trusted individuals that can build small businesses themselves off lending to other small businesses. So that's super interesting. Where does the Maple token come in this value breakup?
Yeah, so it is a governance token. And then it can be staked. So by staking it, you can participate in the network fees. And that's because in some way you're helping to secure the network. So we have the fees that goes to Treasury from the origination fees. In Maple V2, you'll have a portion of interest that will go to the Treasury. And so the Treasury can allocate part of that for you know, continued development, or it can use part of it to repurchase the token and push it to stakers who have staked. So if you stake at MPL, you get XMPL. And then you can receive a portion of the fees in the form of repurchased MPL tokens.
And that's voted on every time, or is that already on auto?
So we've done 50% of fees that were earned over a period of time through originations. And then what will happen is that periodically that can be decided upon by governance.
Got it. And so at this point, it sounds like it is already fully decentralized, or is there still like a private company, Maple, that... has, you know, you mentioned like the salespeople, there's a whole team of 40 people behind making this happen.
So we have a DAO multisig that will handle treasury allocation decisions. It pushes the contract updates and, you know, and it implements anything that's decided with respect to, you know, use of fees and MPL. And currently that DAO multisig will pay grants to a development company. So we have a private development company that applies to receive a grant every quarter, and that funds development and software development, business development on a cost basis.
Got it. Yeah.
So in that way, it's we're pursuing the path of progressive decentralization. Mm-hmm. So I think I look at some of the other projects that have fully decentralized into sub-DAOs, and they are unable to execute projects of any meaningful degree of complexity. We want to avoid that. And so I see an approach where you need accountability of the core team.
Yes.
So we have the multisig. I would see that over time we're going to evolve and have the multisig have members who are elected by token holders. Mm-hmm. So it would be like a staggered representation. So you have tokens, you can vote on somebody who goes onto the multisig. And then the multisig is almost like a similar to a board of directors where it holds core team accountable and you know can replace core team if required. And then day-to-day operations is delegated to core team. So us to you know continue with development, implement and set strategy, and manage day-to-day operations, because it's not operationally feasible to put every day-to-day decision to a token holder vote or to have you know the multi-sig decide. So you still need some segregation of ownership and management just for efficiency,
but
you always want accountability of the management component.
That kind of is a great segue to you know I think a big issue that's happening in crypto today, which is on one hand you have you know, we have decentralization, but we have very, very low voter turnout where a lot of times, you know, protocols maybe have 2% of token holders show up. And then number two, there's also, I think, a lot of bloat where because there isn't leadership, because there is nobody like taking final responsibility. I've seen several, especially DeFi 1.0 protocols with crazy high salaries, maybe very little innovation happened in the last 2 years. A lot of times original founders checked out, stepped down. Where do you find that, like, why do you think that is? Because it seems like very unique to Web3.
I think it's due to a lack of accountability. So you have lack of accountability and lack of shared mission or vision, call it. So if you look at a lot of the DeFi 1.0, even DeFi 2.0, I think was kind of guilty of this, but you had, they decided we're a DAO, and then that meant that somebody who's contributing maybe 3 hours a week is making a huge salary, like a monster salary and a monster token allocation relative to the amount of work they're actually putting in. And they're not being held accountable because the assumption was, you know, they could hire it as an anonymous avatar, participate in forums, show up on video calls, off video. They have no reputation or skin in the game. So maybe they're even doing it as like three or four different personas collecting salaries and token allocations from these DAOs. So I think what you needed was a shift from kind of amateur contribution to professionalization. So we hire people. We're entirely known and doxed. Every member of the team is 100% in and putting their reputation behind what we do. And you know they sign contracts. So they sign contracts with an entity that receives grants to continue this development. So it's much more professionalized. And then you know because we're all known to each other, there is more of a sense of ownership and kind of shared mateship or camaraderie and buy-in into what we're doing. And so we place a great emphasis on things like culture. We do a weekly all hands. We have, you know, functional business units within Maple, like marketing, legal, sales and business development and engineering. And so each of those will have a line manager. And so you have a much more professional organization where you have people doing stand-ups every day. You have a weekly leadership team meeting. They have KPIs which are tied to their performance in their role responsibilities. And everyone has clearly defined role responsibilities. I think, you know, what happened in DeFi 1.0 is just characteristic of the fact that there was no overall leadership or professionalization of management. And there were no clear role responsibilities. It was just kind of show up,
it's
kind
like
of
free-floating,
volunteer for things.
Revolutionizing the world. Everything is changing. But the you know the irony about crypto a lot of times, and I think people, this is why we still get a lot of flack, is that we commend these massive market caps. But when you ask, what lives are you actually touching, right? Like who's your customer, right? I think there's an inordinate amount of blockchain technology that is still lacking a customer, right? And so this is where I can flex you for a little bit. You guys have originated $1.6 billion worth of loans. Right? Something along those lines. Maybe you can give some clarity as to, like, you know, since you have, you know, an actual structure, it's a real business, you have sales teams and so forth, who are your customers so far?
Yeah, so on the we have originated over $1.6 billion mm-hmm. in loans, and this was since May of 2021.
So just a bit over a year.
Yeah, so just a bit over a year. And the core customer segment on the borrower side mm-hmm. was financial institutions. So it was market makers mm-hmm. and delta neutral trading funds
yep.
and some diversified financial institutions. So to actually break down what they are, so a market maker is a firm. Good examples would be Wintermute,
yep.
Amber Group, Oros, GSR, Jump. All of these, you know, have market making business lines. Mm-hmm. But effectively, what you're doing is you are providing the service of liquidity mm-hmm. to exchanges like Coinbase, FTX, Binance, mm-hmm. Huobi. And the reason you're doing that is because those exchanges can't trade against their clients.
Yep.
So you would have seen there has been criticism of, you know, BitMEX from, you know, years ago, which was that they were trading against their clients. Mm-hmm. Another way of looking at that is that they were actually just providing liquidity to their clients. You don't want right. to go and try and buy a coin and not find that there's anyone willing to sell it to you on BitMEX or Binance or any of those centralized exchanges. So,
and market making itself is generally should be delta neutral, and it's very capital intensive.
It is. It's hugely capital intensive because think of it like a shop which is turning over inventory hundreds of times a day, mm-hmm. like a, you know, a fruit and veg store that needs to replace the entirety of its inventory hundreds of times a day.
Yeah,
that's what's happening. So your market makers act as a separate arm that is unrelated to the exchange, and they will borrow from us and from other providers, mm-hmm. and they'll post both sides. So they'll post buy orders and sell orders for Bitcoin and US dollars, as well as other, you know, Bitcoin, ETH, other altcoins. Mm-hmm. And they'll do that on the exchange. And their business model is they'll take a few basis points on each trade, but yep. they have KPIs to hit where they need to provide liquidity around, you know, X amount of liquidity around the bid-ask spread, midpoint of the bid-ask spread.
And in a year like this where we had the, you know, the situation with Three Arrows happen, and it's not just Three Arrows because they were not a market maker, but you've had, you know, Jump and Genesis and a couple other people get a little bit battered and bruised. If one of those were to take a loan from Maple, how much transparency do the lenders get out of what's happening? Mm-hmm. And then do they have the ability to pull the loan? Because, you know, part of the issue what happened with Three Arrows is that all the lenders start like pulling their loans, or mm-hmm. is there like a fixed time frame where they, you know,
yeah.
they have to repay by?
The answer is that it actually varies. So we have fixed term loans.
Yep.
So this could be 30, 60, 90, 180 day
okay.
loans, and they repay them at the end. And mm-hmm. then maybe they refinance them if they want to continue holding it. And
right.
That requires an assessment of their financials. So you're always looking. Loans on Maple do not get approved by the delegate unless they've met the borrower for mm-hmm. a call. The borrower's completed a due diligence questionnaire going into the nature of their business, how mm-hmm. they manage liquidity risk, market risk, leverage, what custody solution they use. Then they'll provide most recent audited financials, mm-hmm. and then they'll provide monthly management accounts. So you can Got see it. The performance of their business month to month. So it's not just that the loans are backed by a reputation, mm-hmm. like we think this person is good. You're actually looking at their accounts every month to see that they have a healthy financial business and that they're not over-levered.
It's not just a letter by Kyle Davies that says, we have $10 billion AUM, signed Kyle Davies.
Yeah, we never lent to 3AC, and it was, you know,
yeah.
not being able to get comfortable with that. And but 3AC was a different beast because they were expressing ultimately expressing a directional view.
Correct.
And so their business was not profiting from, you know, trades with
arbitrage,
not profiting from arbitrage and providing liquidity. And the other way that market makers profit is they'll get rebates from the exchanges. Instead, it was expressing a view that, you know, Avalanche or Bitcoin or ETH or, you know, any of the others, crypto assets they were holding was going to appreciate in value relative to the US, you know, relative to the US dollar.
Right. And doing that on lever.
Yeah. And so they did that on leverage. And so they took out collateralized loans from some of the large CeFi players. And they, you know, they posted the collateral. The trade went against them in mm-hmm. that, you know, there was a sharp depreciation in the assets they held. And that then meant that the CeFi lenders needed to liquidate the collateral that they had provided. In some cases, the collateral was too illiquid,
mm-hmm.
like the GBTC shares that they posted for some of the loans, or other illiquid altcoins, or it might have been, I think in some cases they were posting private equity But all of this meant that in summary, it was too illiquid to liquidate and close out the loan without incurring a loss. Whereas the borrowers on Maple strictly tried to focus on delta neutral and market makers. So that means we're not having to assess like what collateral can they provide, can it be liquidated, because we're not looking at people who are trying to take a view on the market. So we're not sitting there watching Bitcoin, the Bitcoin price going, shit, some of these borrowers are going to be underwater. Instead, all of our borrowers should be market neutral.
Does Maple track all the money that is lent to individual parties? So like, let's say, for example, let's say there is Hartman Yield Fund, doesn't exist, right? But let's say I have a fund, yield fund, and I want to borrow, right? And I borrow from Delegate 1, he gives me money, right? Like, and if I go to Delegate 2 and try to borrow money from him too, would he have insight that I've already borrowed via Maple from someone else before?
Yes, it's entirely posted on the, there's a, on the website, the web app, you can go to loan details page for each pool and you can see who all of the borrowers are and whether their loan is currently outstanding. And you can see that they are repaying it in real time. So I think that transparency prevents things like this. But it also means if you're lending into one of the Maple pools, you don't wake up with a surprise headline one day that some borrower has defaulted who was 50% of that loan book without you understanding. So that was the case. And so that was one of the issues with CeFi, is you could have a CeFi lender who extended a loan that might have been 40% of their balance sheet to one counterparty.
Jesus. So I interrupted you in the process. You said, when I asked you who were like the customers, we started with market makers. Who were some of the other, I guess, institutions, and how do you find them? How do you actively recruit them?
Yeah, so you've got, on the borrow side, you've got market makers, market neutral funds. We are trying to expand into proof of work miners, Web3 infrastructure, and fintechs. So we want to get outside of the narrower, you know, this narrow, one narrow segment of the market. So from a, you know, innovator's dilemma, we found our initial wedge. We found good product market fit there. Now we want to expand and, you know, move into a wider addressable opportunity. How we find them, you know, had been just, you know, B2B sales grind. So I've been showing up at conferences, getting warm introductions. Where we're trying to move to now is also expanding our lender side of the market. So these are the people depositing into the pools. Again, it's predominantly institutional. So I think it's about 86% of deposits are over $1 million in size. And so it's mostly, this could be hedge funds, single family or multifamily offices, high net worths, as well as other, you know, institutional and professional asset managers who are depositing to these pools. What they like about it, you know, relative to the cash yield they can get in other, you know, fixed income or lending opportunities, it's going to be a wider yield. Also, it's self-custodial, so they can deposit in. They're not just giving money to somebody else. As I said before, you know, that kind of CeFi black box. They're putting it in a pool. They can withdraw from the pool when loans are being repaid. And it's, you know, it's governed by smart contracts there. And then they like the transparency, so they can always see who all the borrowers are, and they get real-time reporting. So they can always see who is borrowing from the pool, are they making their repayments, is the pool overly concentrated to one borrower, has anyone defaulted? You know, and in terms of credit risk management, we actually fared very well over the Q2 period. So on a loan book outstanding of $900 million at the start of June, there was a single $10 million default.
I was going to ask you, have there any been defaults? And so like, what kind of went wrong there and lessons learned?
So there's one default. That loan is still going through a restructuring process. But the lesson learned was, don't deal with diversified financial businesses because they have multiple business lines where an issue in one can be commingled with a soundly performing business in the other business line. And so the visibility is limited.
Small points of failure.
So we came, you know, we came together with the delegates, did postmortems on this. The delegates are concentrating more on monoline businesses. So, you know, pure play market makers or arbitrage traders or other sectors. But they're not doing ones that might be doing lending, market making, trading, some other activity, because that's where you get less visibility into the underlying health of that business and where there is kind of, you know, more operational risk. Because they might be commingling the wallets that that are running several different business lines. So it's just kind of, it's hard to get the same visibility.
It's hard to keep a track,
versus just dealing with a monoline market making business. So that was one of the things. It was also probably a borrower's market 6 months ago. So borrowers were able to get looser terms in general because there was a flood of money, because structurally, there were a lot of VC rounds going to like centralized lenders or other parties. And this meant there was a race for volume. And so you're writing volume at the expense of pricing and at the expense of looser credit terms.
Yeah.
Now it's shifted. It's much more of a lender's market. Mm-hmm. So tighter credit terms, better pricing. And so with Maple's...
It's a lender's market, although the interest rates have massively contracted.
Correct.
Yeah.
So, well, interest rates widened significantly. So they were probably 6, 7, 8% back in March, April. And you had to fight to get, you know, 8, 9, 10. Then May, June, July, they go out to, you know, mid double digits. So 13, 14, 15. August, September, they're starting to contract back to, you know, 9, 10, 11%.
Oh, okay. So in the uncollateralized one, because I was thinking like on Aave and stuff like that, it's dropped to, you know, basis points at this point, I think.
Yeah. Aave is like the over-collateralized lending protocols, I think have now been flipped by treasury bills. So
yeah.
Treasury bills, you're now better just parking your money with the US government than in a smart contract.
Yeah.
Who'd have thought? But so, you know, treasuries widened to like, you know, 3 and something at the moment. Meanwhile, crypto rates, you know, uncollateralized borrow went from 13, 14. Now it's kind of closer to, you know, 10, 11, 12.
Yeah.
And so we've actually seen a contraction, whereas before treasuries were near zero, crypto rates were, you know, 9, 10, 11. So you had, you know, 9, 10, 11% spread because you were effectively compared to zero basis.
Yeah.
But now it's sort of contracted and maybe maybe it's like 5, 6, 7 corporate crypto credit spread.
Super interesting. I'm sure you said you've been building a sales force and you're trying to go beyond just the crypto ecosystem, which I think, by the way, is super important because something I always found weird, which I discuss on my IC regularly, is that why is it like with Web2, it touched everybody, right? So, for example, I didn't work at Uber, but I still used Uber, right? I didn't work at Airbnb, I still use Airbnb. But with crypto, unless you work in crypto, you're not using most of these products, right?
Yeah.
And so you guys are looking to go beyond, you know, the little crypto bubble, which is great. What's been some of the things that, you know, maybe non-crypto institutions are saying about using something like Maple? Is this that they say, oh, there's so much more regulation needs to happen first? Or is this like, we're actually setting up in the next 3 months? Like, you know, we have similar conversation about investing crypto funds, but I'm curious what they think about using crypto infrastructure for their entities.
It is interesting because, like, touching on some of the points you made around Web2 adoption, but first of all, I'll say, so there are people who kind of differentiate what is a known business, which is lending and credit origination, because it is happening on chain. I view that just as a settlement layer. So I could write a loan to you, you sign a promissory note, and there's no, like, and we just trade cash. So there's no infrastructure involved. Whereas people treat it differently when it's happening on chain, but it's in effect the same in principle business activity. I have originated credit to you, you have an obligation to repay me. But they're concerned that it's not enforceable if it's on chain, yet me just giving you giving me a piece of paper,
and
me giving you a piece of cash would still be enforceable, even though there is no, you know, no real record of it. So there's nothing fundamentally different there. So those are the kinds of questions we get. It tends to be a lot around, you know, the enforceability of our legal contracts. Our legal contracts have been reviewed. So, you know, they use choice of jurisdiction is the state of New York. So largely enforceable in most financial centers around the world. And, you know, we actually saw that with this, you know, the default that happened, like the legal contracts and the validity of those was not contested. So you have questions around legal enforceability of a loan that's been done on chain. I think, you know, that'll eventually get settled as more activity comes on chain. You'll have defaults that prove precedent. Then you have some of the other aspects are an institution wants a deposit, but they require a qualified custodian. So you had this middle ground where you've got MetaMask or Ledger, which is entirely self-custodial.
Yep.
You have the middle ground, which I'll touch on in a sec, like Copper, Fireblocks, MPC,
Gnosis. It's like SOC2, but I don't think it's SOC1,
Which increasingly is being classified as a custodial solution because you might have a third party. So you have, you know, borrower, lender, and you could have a third party sitting in the middle, which is a signer on an MPC.
Yeah.
And that means, you know, if that party is a qualified custodian, then even though they're not holding your assets in custody, that counts as a custody solution, is what we're finding. So I think as the market is more aware of that, you'll get more institutions willing to move in. And then you have the full service provider, which is Anchorage or Fidelity or, you know,
BitGo.
Or BitGo. And that's like, you just get a statement of what your, you know, what your balance is with them. They entirely control it. You have no ability to deposit or withdraw. You're sending money to them, and they are managing it end to end. So that's furthest along the spectrum. But that custody solution, like an institutional or qualified custodian, was a big impediment. The other is on and off ramps. So the easiest way for Maple to make an apples to apples comparison, that this is, in my view, 100x better way of running lending infrastructure than, you know, than what I used to do at a bank, is if we can offer the product to the same types of customers. So let your taste buds decide. So if we had a fintech that could borrow from us, or, you know, not from us, but from one of the Maple pools, and could borrow from a bank or a credit fund, and then they can take down a loan from us, they will see how much better it is. But for them to be able to do that, a lot of them want like an off-ramp. They don't want to take a loan in USDC.
Got it.
Even though I do most of my banking now in USDC because it's so much lower cost. But they want to be able to take down fiat into a bank account, pay out salaries, pay vendors. When we have good off-ramp solutions, that comparison will be much clearer, that they can just go and repay, you know, on our web app, like hit request loan, hit...
Circle doesn't have that yet.
I feel like that's Circle, has that. Yeah. Circle has that. It's just the percentage adoption of the market where it is today versus where we would like it to be is you know, we're just very early. These are like the first customers using mobile phones. So, you know, what you're saying about Web2 adoption, I mean, you know, in 2002, my, you know, my parents weren't using Google to check restaurant recommendations.
That is fair.
So I think, you know, we're deep in the space. So we're, you know, we're sitting there banging the table going, you know, when are more people going to use this?
Yeah.
But, you know, it is worth remembering that, you know, Amazon was started in the mid 90s and, you know, people weren't by default going to make book purchases on there until, you know, well into the 2000s. So it does just take time, but that's one of the core pieces that I think is missing and which we are actively trying to explore and push forward so that we can, you know, make, give people a chance to make an apples to apples comparison.
Regulation. A lot of people think it's, they're afraid of any crypto. Other people think, especially when you're trying to onboard big institutions, it might be helpful. Are there any types of regulation that you say like, hey, this would actually be helpful to, like, you know, advance, let's say, DeFi further? Or are there also some things that, you know, might be on the, you know, might be happening right now that you think are more damaging than good?
So the common trope or the common remark is that we're lacking regulatory clarity.
Yeah.
This is actually an important statement. So you have, there is regulatory clarity for the people who are participating in the space, creating startups like us. And then there is regulatory clarity for the customers who are sitting on the sidelines going, we want to be able to participate here, but our legal and compliance teams can't get comfortable that we are allowed to without having a license yanked from us. We're not sure what would be the catalyst for that license to be yanked from us. And so we're wanting clarity on that. And there's several funds that raised hundreds of millions of dollars that have still been not able to deploy that or put it to work in a meaningful way in the space because their legal teams can't get comfortable as to, you know, that there aren't consequences just for them, you know, maybe interacting with a decentralized exchange or a decentralized lending protocol. And so that is the hidden cost of regulatory uncertainty, which arises because there are not clear statements or guidance put around who can use a platform, you know, what aspects of usage would be considered contravening, you know, securities laws or other laws.
Right. And like, I guess in the lending space, I don't know, in the traditional lending space, do you need to have a license to lend out? Do you need to be accredited? Are there any kind of like rules like that?
If you, it varies jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but you would have, you know, if you're focused on retail lending, there's more heavy licensing around that for obvious reasons that, you know, people could be doing predatory, like highly predatory payday like loans.
Yeah,
loan shark type activities. Institutional business or commercial lending is less regulated because generally you're deemed to be dealing with a more sophisticated counterparty. And that's subject to a bit of a reasonableness test. You know, if you're lending to a local cafe and it's a smaller loan, they're going to be less sophisticated than if you're lending to a market maker who is connected to 80 different exchanges around the world. So they're deemed to be more sophisticated to know what they're doing. They have their own, you know, GCs, they have external counsel who's advising them. So that's less regulated. And then it depends what kind of deposits you're taking. You know, Maple is a product that skews more institutional. We didn't try and, you know, we and the delegates did not try and take deposits from, you know, retail, like retail depositors or you know, moms and pops. We think the product is you know, suits a more institutional customer. They are able, they are familiar with corporate debt. They are familiar with institutional lending, and, they're not depositing their life savings on there.
Right. That kind of brings me to, a second question, which hasn't not directly to do with Maple, but I feel like it's something you've probably thought about. Since for retail, we only have over-collateralized lending for the last 2 years or so, like every now and then the topic of like credit scores comes up. But the problem with credit scores and crypto is that like technically you can always Sybil it where I can make 10 wallets, all of them have good behavior for a while, and then I, rip the lender off. What's your take on credit scores for DeFi? Is it something that's feasible? And if so, what would that look like? Or do you just think that the delegate model just works better because you have a trusted party that has responsibility, so to say, to vet?
Well, we went through the idea maze ourselves, and we came out at the, at the conclusion that the delegate model worked better for us. But remember, we also came from institutional banking and credit backgrounds. And so we also wanted to make a model where, it catered to that middle market space. Having come from banking, like prudential capital requirements mean that banks are slowly seeding the middle market lending to institutional borrowers who might be, 50 million in size up to like hundreds of millions in size. If you're not large enough to have an S&P rating, and if you're not publicly listed, or if you're not, multi-billion dollar institution, then you're not going to get really competitive pricing from a bank unless you go, like effectively a real estate backed loan. So where are you going? You're going to credit funds. And when you go to credit funds in the middle market, or just, a touch beyond venture debt, you're probably going to have to give up equity warrants. You might be paying a mid-teens rate. So it's a pretty uncompetitive market. And that's because structurally, that market has a very low level of supply of lenders. And that's because it's very hard to operationally set up a lending business. There's no good tech stack you can build on. The legal costs of setting up an SPV, getting onboarded with a bank, roadshowing to raise funds, it's hugely costly business. So that's why they tend to favor that like mid-teens lending rate and then taking kickers like equity warrants and things like that. So I think what we want to do is expand the market so that it's trivially simple, much simpler and lower cost to set up and run a middle market lending business or, credit fund targeting that space. And we're doing that by giving them the tech stack that means that they have a structurally lower cost to income ratio versus a bank or versus another credit fund. And we think that is good for the private sector. That is good for the economy across the board because you will have better access to capital for institutions that are profitable, that have grown beyond the venture debt stage or beyond the stage where it makes sense to continue raising venture capital. And, we think that's good for a vibrant and healthy economy. So that's really what we want to target. Coming back to your question, because I am giving a bit of a long-winded answer, but you have retail. So in retail lending, you have the FICO credit score run by Equifax. And you have under-collateralized lending. Might be in the form of credit card loans, personal loans. So people have said, does this make sense? Because you could have civil attacks. So there are there's two schools of thought. There is the idea that you link that with an off-chain identity and then you scrape information from their bank account and other information to create a full picture of who that individual is and what their credit worthiness is. There's another school of thought that you only look at on-chain activity, and this is reflected in the different teams that are tackling this today. So I was on a call with Spectral earlier today, and so they're doing like an on-chain credit score. So this would look at your on-chain activity. The limitation of looking at on-chain credit scores is that most people are not conducting, 95% of their financial activity on-chain at the moment. So that's a limitation. If that changed in future, that makes it much more feasible. And then there's the, the off-chain school of thought, which is that you'll connect with their bank account, but then you need to pay for middleware like Plaid or other services to do that. And so it's not more cost-effective because you're paying additional people for the technology to do that. But I actually bring it back to the conceptually, you will have fraud of some kind. If you look at PayPal and early credit cards, I was listening to a really good podcast on the founding of Visa. Visa had hundreds of millions of fraud to begin with, decades ago when they started, and they got that down. PayPal also had a ton of fraud when it started. So any new lending technology will have fraud. But I don't think it's an insurmountable or structural problem that prevents lending being done on chain in an uncollateralized way.
Right. And I think this is happening with DeFi, even with hacks and rug pulls and exploits. Every single time there's a hack, every single time there's a case of fraud, right? You identify the cause and then you can plug that hole. And like it might, it can be costly to plug all the holes over time. But after a while, it does become very fortified where it just doesn't happen as much anymore.
Yeah, yeah. You treat it like research and development costs or a customer acquisition costs. Mm-hmm. But in the early days of PayPal, you know, that prompted Max Levchin to then go and build their anti-fraud, you know, algorithms and defenses. I think the problem is that people assume that because it's on chain and because it's being done with automated smart contracts, it needs to be like, you know, it needs to conform to some kind of platonic or perfect ideal where it is impossible to have fraud or a bad actor. But that's not the case. You just need it in a lending business. If you have a portfolio of $1 billion of loans, you just need the aggregate interest that's paid to exceed the amount of fraud that is coming through the system.
Right.
That means your revenues exceed your cost due to fraud in a nutshell.
Right. Which, you know, that's hopefully that happens. But of course, with some, now I'm thinking back to the hacks again, like when you have these bridge hacks with like hundreds of millions of dollars, well, you don't have fraud on that scale on a lending platform. How big are the biggest loans?
On Maple, the biggest loan that's been done to date was about $80
million. $80
million. The typical average loan size is about $12 million today.
$12 million, right. So even if if there's a case of fraud on an average sized loan, that's still less than 1% of origination so far, $1.6 billion. 12.
That's true. But again, different kinds of frauds. And so the mitigants you have, like, whereas if you do a retail loan and somebody commits fraud, the way they're doing it is like a fake ID. It's like identity, impersonation, and fraud. Taking out a loan in somebody else's name, and then they run off with it. And the cost of pursuit of that fraud would generally exceed the amount that you get back, because it might be a $10,000 loan. But in, you know, an institutional lending, here the borrower is signing a loan agreement, so they have recourse. You can wind up the company, you know, petition for insolvency, or wind up proceeding. But you've also, in this case, received, you know, audited financials from at least the last year, in a normal state, and you'll have management accounts every month, and you've interviewed management. And increasingly what's happening on the platform is we're using Credora as well, which gives you a view of the trading positions, but in an aggregated sense. So it's like a dashboard that says Felix, you know, Hartman Capital's doing their yield fund, but they're delta neutral hedged, or they're 10% unhedged. A 1% move up or down in Bitcoin impacts their equity position in this manner. So it gives you real time insight from most of the trading funds that are on the platform.
That's cool. I got two more questions for you and then a couple of small rapid fire ones. One, tokenomics. We had a quick discussion before we started about where we talked about incentives, you know, like DeFi 1.0 really came to be when it was really brought into life because of incentives. Comp rewards kind of kicked it all off, and then, you know, SushiSwap rewards and so forth. You guys still have, and you have some level of incentives as well, but you also said you started actually building a sales force and, like, you know, rewarding sales like into traditional world. How do you view striking the right balance when it comes to building tokenomics? And I also remember you, it might have been either with, I told you I listened to all of them, either with Jeremy Lehrer or with Jason Joy, and you said, you know, people get it wrong. Tokenomics are just, you know, they're just like a feature. It's not the product, right? The product is the product. Tokenomics are not it, right? And so how do you strike the right balance with, you know, utilizing tokenomics to the best degree without, like, it becoming self-destructive?
I think it does boil down to that sentence you mentioned, where the product is the product, the token is not the product. So the token is a representation of either governance or, you know, incentive structures built into the product, but the product needs to stand on its own two legs. So, you know, you have to have, if you're making Coca-Cola, people have to want to buy and drink Coca-Cola. You can't have a Coca-Cola token that abstracts that away.
And pays people to drink Coca-Cola.
Yeah. And you get paid, you know, a yield to drink Coca-Cola, which exceeds the cost of buying Coca-Cola in the first place. If you look at it, that's kind of effectively your customer acquisition
cost. Unless it gets them addicted. You know, I think that's what drug dealers do, right? Like, they give some free samples and they get addicted to it and they'll repeat customers.
But that is a SaaS-based business model or a subscription-based business model where you have a lifetime value of a customer, and then the initial customer acquisition cost is still less than the lifetime value of the customer.
Right.
What we had in DeFi was that the lifetime value of the customer was less than the customer acquisition cost. So you had a negative gross margin business, in my view, for most of DeFi 2.0. Yep. And so I think what you need to do is you have to have a product that stands alone where somebody is willing to use it. In our case, we have a marketplace, so two sides. Somebody needs to be willing to deposit to receive a yield, and bear credit risk. And then on the other side, you have to have a borrower who wants to take funds at a rate, repay the loan with interest, but use it in their business. And so earlier on, we had borrowers who were willing to do that at, you know, high single, low double digits.
Yep.
But we had lenders who were not willing to do that for less than, you know, mid, high double digits. Now, and that was because the opportunity cost was that people would go into like five different,
right,
you know, DeFi
Anchor
protocols.
Was still around. 20%.
Exactly. The number of people who said the risk-free rate is 19% because that's what I'm getting paid on Anchor. A lot of these were sophisticated investors. So people who think that Anchor was purely born by retail, there were a lot of very smart people who were putting money in there and saying it was risk-free. Whenever you get a yield, you are being paid to bear some kind of risk.
Yep.
It is either depegging risk, it is smart contract risk. In our case, it's credit risk.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's happened is that the market has come down where there are not a dozen different opportunities to get a yield. And so you're no longer being compared on just what is the APY number. Now it's a much more nuanced take where people are saying, what risk am I being paid to bear? Yep. What is the hidden risk being built into this yield? And so that's meant that Maple has wound down the MPL customer acquisition cost that was being paid out. And, you know, a new pool was launched, which is about 40 mil by Maven 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that has no incentivization built in. So this is, you know, purely sustainable. The yield that is paid by the borrowers, fees are deducted from that. And then the rate is passed on to the lenders, all non-custodially. And that has been high enough to create a sustainable market on both sides. On the other pools, that has been wound down over time to the point where it's now, you know, 1 or 1.5% APY, so annual rate, and it's going to be wound down before the end of the year to zero. And so it will be entirely sustainable, where the yield borrowers pay net of fees is enough to compensate lenders for wanting to, you know, to bear the credit risk there. But that's because we focused on product. So we built out and improved the user experience. We improved, you know, how we sell, and also our awareness, like the awareness of how risk is managed on Maple, got people more comfortable with using it. So, you know, we talk about the legal enforceability, how borrower financials are assessed, and so that just took a lot of time to kind of build that awareness and educate the market on how that works.
And it's funny because based on the market is what people optimize for. In a bull market, even though there's so much upside, they're optimizing for even more upside. In a bear market, when there's a lot of downside, they're just optimizing for mitigating downside because that's what's in their, like, I guess, front and center of their awareness, right?
I question at the moment, there are some other protocols like Curve, for example. Mm-hmm. So I question, what is a world in which there aren't five or six different stablecoins paying emissions, and there is one to two dominant stablecoins. And if Curve is not paying the Curve token, and if that token is not being locked up in Convex, what does that world look like for everyone who's participating on that protocol? Is that a protocol that actually is sustainable and generating revenues that entice people to be liquidity providers? Do you want to hold three different kinds of stablecoin? If one of them is USDC and another is Tether and another is like an algo stablecoin of some kind, or it's only partially collateralized, do you want to hold that stablecoin and bear, you know, that risk? Because effectively you're holding, you know, 33% in a three-way pool.
I gave a talk at a German seminar in April, and I said that somebody asked me, what's the potential Plex Swan you could see happening? Yeah. And I was like, it's not a regulation. It's not all the stuff that people talk about. I have two cases, either one Anchor or because of all the dependency in the Luna ecosystem, or two Curve, right? Because even with Curve, you are both delaying and abstracting away pain, right? With like 4-year staking terms, right? Like with all these incentives, like usually those incentives should really damage the system. But because you're pushing it so far out, like it's tomorrow's problem. It's next year's problem.
If the Curve token is worth zero in 4 years, what is your yield currently?
Yeah.
Like you get 4 years, you've been marking profits on it, but it's all locked up and you couldn't access it. It's like somebody who was marking to market their yield on Anchor that they earned, you know, month to month, but they were just like relocking it. Well, effectively, the yield you actually booked, you know, at the, you know, termination was zero. And so if you've locked your Curve tokens for 4 years, and then when there are no longer incentives being paid out and there are no longer five different stable coins, or, you know, derivatives and abstractions of BTC or ETH, then I just wonder what yield did you actually book all that time?
And the vast majority of these stable coins, you know, like the clean exceptions, of course, USDC, USDT, and even BUSD. But the vast majority of stable coins, like, I mean, one is easy to throw under the bus because it just went down, which is Fei, right? So for example, there's a lot of stable coins that, so with UST, for example, I think it was like 85% of UST was in Anchor, right? Mm-hmm. So like, what was the use case for UST? Literally to harvest, right?
Yeah.
And so I think it's very similar with many other stable coins where there literally is no utility yet. Like, you don't use them. I'm not going to say anybody who's still alive, you know, but like, for example, with Fei, like the use case of Fei was minimal. So a lot of it was like on RGT, on Rari, right? Mm-hmm. And some was like on Curve. But if you take away the incentives from Curve, right? If you take away, you know, the incentives, like people like in like borrowing on Rari, what's the point of the existence? And you're right, it would reduce from having, let's say, a world of 20 stable coins down to 2 or 3, and then you don't need to swap between them as much anymore, which furthermore reduces the need for them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, functionally, you're being paid to give, as we talked about with CeFi, you're being paid to give an unsecured loan to a smart contract protocol.
Yeah.
With, yeah, zero recourse.
Interesting. Last one before the rapid fire. You recently moved to Solana on top of ETH, so you're officially multi-chain now. One, why Solana? And two, how do you see, what's your view on multi-chain in general? You know, are you an ETH maxi? Are you, do you believe that, you know, we'll be on 20 chains in the future? Do you think there'll be consolidation, layer ones, layer twos, Cosmos? I don't know. What's your take on building on different chains?
My own take is that there is room for multiple chains, but each chain needs to serve, either needs to find product market fit in some way. And so, you know, just in the same way that you have different hotel chains, so you have the budget hotel chains, you have the high-end luxury hotel chains, and then you have Airbnb, different business models, but the market is large enough that they can each coexist and be a, you know, thriving business. So what we like, so we are multi-chain on Solana. What we like about Solana is that it is significantly differentiated engineering. So, you know, it's monolithic, it runs parallel processing, it's leveraged towards hardware, and then it has an interesting kind of management and governance structure where, you know, you have a core team that is engineering and following a roadmap. ETH, more decentralized, larger transaction volume. We expect improvements to come, you know, with proof of stake, also with, you know, sharding in future. But I think, you know, there is very good product market fit with ETH. We have, you know, that is kind of the bulk of our TVL on the platform. But we like the differentiated aspect of Solana. And I'm very intrigued by what they're doing with, you know, the Solana mobile stack, Helium moving there. Like, I think there's a vibrant market that can be built on top of that infrastructure. And so what we wanted to do with Maple was hedge and develop differentiated engineering expertise so that we can engineer on two different sets of infrastructure. But what we want to do is have the products kind of deviate along each of those chains. So Maple Solana shouldn't look like a clone of Maple Ethereum. It should leverage some of the differentiated aspects that are possible from, you know, from the way that the chain is architected. So leverage to speed, distribution through a mobile stack, maybe serving, you know, maybe it could finance a wholesale provider of Helium hotspots, for example. But I'm looking for differentiation. I don't see a world in which Maple is just duplicated across every different layer one in a largely carbon copy version of what we have on Ethereum. What we've always said when we've been in discussions with other L1 teams is that we would look for either a differentiated set of borrowers. So let's say that there was one industry that was dead keen on only being on, you know, one alternative L1 chain. Let's say Avalanche. So if you had an industry that was size of billions of dollars and they found product market fit where they were very keen on subnets, then that would be a very attractive market to go and serve. And so it's not something that we could serve with what we've built on Ethereum or on Solana. So that's just an example, hypothetically. But it's that differentiation aspect that we need to go and explore other chains.
Now, this makes a lot of sense because, you know, last year was a big multi-chain year. And I noticed, for example, like Sushi was one of the companies that just went on every single chain. And what you end up having
fragments your focus.
It fragments your focus. And especially when it comes to DEX, it fragments your liquidity as well, where it's like, in the end, Sushi was not the greatest source of liquidity on any chain. Instead of like dominating one and being the best source of liquidity there, it would end up being nowhere. It's of course different with you, but then because since you know it's again it's not like a liquidity on a DEX, it's more so like you know you create one pool, but again you want people to go to one place where they know like okay this is where I check you know they don't want to be on 10 different chains.
And the idea that was pitched to us by a lot of our one chains was go and be the first under collateralized lending protocol on this other chain, and therefore there's this X you know $1 million of TVL that you can capture. But that was a short-sighted game to race to the top of a local hill that was, you know, it's a local maxima that is smaller than the global maxima
and
you can achieve.
Capped out much faster, and then you have upkeep on so many chains because, you know, every time they do protocol upgrade, you now have to, like, you know, maintain audit costs and so forth. So makes a lot of sense. Final couple of rapid-fire questions before we... We're in a bear market now. How do you think maybe, you know, it's super cycle. It's just a little break in the super cycle. We all get, listen, I've actually noticed, and this is fascinating. Most of my crypto friends, we were also burnt out in the last 2 years where for the first time I walked down the street and I saw Ari, he was like smiling and happy. I'm like, this man finally got some rest, right? Shout out Ari. And you know, it's so with many of us, right? Same thing with me. I finally took Labor Day weekend. I took it off. Wow, I haven't taken a weekend off. Anyway, what are some bear market challenges? Or also, like, you know, what do you focus more? Like, how has your leadership style or your focus shifted since the bull market?
It's a good question. So a couple of things change in the bear market. So you have external or extraneous factors. Mm-hmm. You can't control these. And so you have to wear them. So bear it, you know, avoid it or try and, you know, maneuver around that problem, or kind of, you know, push through it. So some of the things we couldn't control, there was definitely less appetite to deposit into, you know, into crypto protocols. So the supply side of our market dried up a lot. It's starting to come back now. So people were super risk off where they just didn't trust anything. Everyone wanted to just be in cash. Now that's starting to normalize. People are no longer afraid that there is, you know, hidden contagion to 3AC that is still yet to be unearthed. So more people are willing to come back in the market. That's something that we couldn't control. We just had to weather. And but one of the things we could control is we didn't want to be only leveraged to borrowers and lenders who are crypto native. So it prompted us to try and get around that problem by starting to look at outside sectors and industries, whether it's fintechs, you know, whether it's looking at solutions like on-off ramps. So that was, you know, that was kind of how we dealt with the, call it the extraneous market. Then there's the, you know, the internal factors that we could control. So this was, you know, how was people's morale? So you might have had people on the team who were trading or investing elsewhere. You know, now their net wealth is down. And so they might have been depressed. Maybe they were in anchor. Maybe they knew people who were in anchor. And so you can control team motivation. So how did leadership change internally? We tried to reaffirm a clear mission, a path through the challenges of today, towards, you know, what we want to achieve longer term, and maintaining a clear focus. So what we didn't do is we didn't panic and throw six different things at the wall and go, we got to try all these different products. We got to lend to all these different people. And we got to introduce 10 different features. We kept focused on the most important thing is the most important thing. If you have 10 priorities, you have no priorities. So we just kept a really narrow focus so that it was easy for everyone to prioritize things. Then we managed expectations. So if you ever read like Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, it was the people who were like overly optimistic in the concentration camps who were kind of the first to give up. But if you manage expectations and you learn to love the grind and, you know, you expect that we managed everyone's expectations, it was going to be really hard to find clients. It was going to be really hard to find traction. There were a lot of people who were going to call, you know, DeFi and, you know, on-chain businesses scams, and that it was going to be hard. So if you expect that, if you expect a really tough marathon, then as you're going through it, you're not surprised to the downside. And so that helped people a lot as well. And then we kept, you know, fairly open lines of communication with everyone on the team. So a lot of, you know, touching base, we are remote teams. And so, you know, the advantage is people can get space, but the disadvantage is that they can sometimes feel disconnected. So we try to keep, you know, really clear lines of communication. So clear goals and expectations, clear set of priorities, managing people's expectations is going to be really tough. I think another good lesson on this comes from like William Shackleton, who was, of course, took a ship on a voyage of exploration. They got trapped in the ice, and then they had to kind of last in freezing conditions for a very long period of time, then trek to safety. But I remember listening to a podcast about this, which talked about how he managed everyone's energy levels and motivation during that ordeal. And so keeping those things in mind, we knew it was going to be tough. And so I feel like we're coming to more normalized conditions, but it's still not going to be easy. So we try and maintain focus. We set OKRs for Q3. We're setting OKRs for Q4. We have a team offsite that's coming up next month, and that's going to give us a chance, particularly for new starters, to come together in person, reorient them and kind of reacquaint them with Maple's story, our mission, our values, why we do what we do, and give them a chance to kind of work and collaborate together in things like brainstorming sessions, solving problems. Really? That was a very long-winded answer.
No, this is awesome. No, like super, fascinating, because, I like the point you put up about the optimism part, because I find myself become a little bit of a Cassandra during like bull markets. Like towards the end, I'm like the most, I don't want to say negative, but I'm like, I sleep worse in bull markets when I start seeing things like SafeMoon and Shiba, and Dogecoin, through the roof. And I've really come to life in bear markets where like I go those extra hours, I push hard. I'm like the most motivated ever in bear markets for some reason.
Yeah.
and equally like the point about, on the flip side, and also like some of my younger analysts back last year that were like so full of energy, right? And so excited by every single move, once the market's like cooling down or getting a little bit more bitter, right? That optimism is like, it's like short-term energy, right? Mm-hmm. It's like a flash in a pan versus like this much more, I think, it's like excitement versus conviction, right? Conviction is like everlasting, like it will be there in a bear market, it will keep it going. Excitement is like, oh, the price is going up today, and that's what gets you out of bed, right?
Yeah. Internal scorecard versus external scorecard. So
price
going up is your external scorecard, where the market's appraising your net worth. The net worth of your portfolio is not your net worth or your value as a person.
Yeah.
If you have an internal scorecard, you can withstand that volatility, and it's more are you conducting yourself in a way that you'd be proud of?
Yeah, and you have your own KPIs where you say like you're not in control of what the price of a token is tomorrow, but you are in control of, like, for example, hey, are we making progress onboarding more customers to Maple, for example?
Yeah. Right? So during the dot-com crash, Amazon was still signing up more people. Like all of their fundamentals were going well, but their stock price was, started at 100, ended at $3 or something at the bottom of the dot-com crash. So you just control what you can control. And they continued building a business that was providing value to people. And so you try and continue building the product that is delivering value to people. The things that will be bumps along the way is that people might be less motivated in a bear market, people less focused. Your customers are pessimistic. Everyone around you is a bit pessimistic. So you just have to kind of like, it's important that you shield your mind from the bad vibes.
100%, because that's the one thing that that keeps you going at that point.
Yeah.
Since you started towards the end of, the beginning of the first inning of the bull market, towards the end of the bear market, what would be your top three tips for a founder that might be considering going full-time crypto and starting something new in this space?
Top three tips. So have, first one, validate that the product has a need, that people want to use your product. A lot of people start with an idea of something that is a cool technology, but they haven't backed out how that is something that people will pay for. It's like, I have a cool way of reading data, or this product kind of exists in TradFi. Something like this could exist in DeFi.
Yeah.
But they didn't realize that the TradFi consumer of that product is large-scale institutions who are using it for hedging. Hedging commodities contracts.
Oh, I burned my fingers on like tranches and options, because in 2020, nobody cared, right? It's like, it's a cool tech. It exists in TradFi, but nobody cares.
Yeah. But the only, in a retail dominated market, who was going to use that where there was nothing really to hedge? Like there was no business need for it. So validate the product.
Yep.
Talk to your potential customers. I can't say this enough. A lot of people think, I'm going to build it and my idea is going to have legs, but they never talk to people as they're building. They never get feedback. And so they wait, and you might have, it's like course correcting. A flight from New York to London is, it's, when you zoom out, it's a straight line. Zoomed in, it's a lot of tiny course corrections. And so you always, talking to customers is your course correction. And so you want to be doing that as much as possible. The other thing is, as you're building a team, look for setting up a professional structure. Set it up the way that you would at the next stage of growth. So have, have a weekly LT meeting, or, you know, at least have daily stand-ups. Set plans and what you're going to do. Because the danger in startups, and in particularly remote startups, is that everybody just goes off and does things, and it's not coming together in a cohesive way.
Yeah.
Somebody might be doing something, you know, you might have developer A and developer B, and developer B has a piece of work that's dependent on developer A completing something, but they have no conception of when A is going to be done. A doesn't know that downstream piece of work is dependent on them. So just clarity and repetition internally as an organization, if you're a startup. Always make it clear what the current priority is, what is not important, and who is doing what.
Right.
I
love the last point. No, because, like, you know, there's the old saying, like, you know, don't trust for the job you have, trust for the job you want. And the same thing goes for, like, act like the company you want to be, not the company you are today.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had to do the same thing with my firm, where, you know, we had what I call like the Hartman Capital 2.0 roadmap, where I said, like, these are the type of clients you have today. These are the type of clients I want to have tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly.
What do we need to look like? Yeah. What do we need to do? Right. Like, from like things like having a cybersecurity firm, like, I don't really need that right now, but like if I want to lock down a big institutional investor, like, those are things that matter, right? And so that's big. And I think that's something that definitely is lacking in crypto. Like you said in the beginning, like, that structure, like having stand-ups, having check-ins, having KPIs, and so forth.
Yeah, there's a couple of ways to fail as a startup. One is to have, you know, a bad product or a bad product idea. That's kind of your failure of vision or your failure of product. But the other one is to have a good product and just not be able to execute on it.
Yeah.
Time and again, good execution will trump a bad product idea. Like, look at Tupperware. I mean, just executed very, very well. And it also helps you last long enough that you might be able to pivot your product idea to something that works much better. But good execution is highly underrated.
Second to last, when you walked in, you were in love with my bookshelf. So you like books. What are your top? What's your top three favorite books that you recommend?
That's a really tough one, actually. So what books do I often come back to? So I think, a couple of ones from history. I really like, there was one called Cyrus the Great, and it's kind of leadership lessons. Leadership lessons from Xenophon's Cyrus the Great. That was really good. Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha is another really good book, short fiction. And then in the non-fiction side of things, because we brought this up before and we're talking about it, Lawrence Friedman, I believe, wrote a book called On Strategy that's like an entire, it's like a 500 or 600 page history of strategy that's incredible. And another one that I read recently was a biography of FDR. So I felt like this was important because, you know, it covered, like, aside from an incredible personal story where he got polio very early, and it wasn't, you know, till 12 years after he got that he became president of the U.S. So talk about overcoming adversity.
Wow.
But also
that, like, getting elected four times.
Yeah. Yeah. And so part of that was, you know, extraneous, like, you had, World War II came about, but his kind of skill set in delegation and getting, you know, focusing on the most important thing, I think is really good. You know, in a career as long as his, you had a lot of mistakes, but he was able to delegate and always prioritize the most important thing. So he got a tremendous amount done, from New Deal to Lend Lease. And what he did was
it was New Deal that also included Social Security, right?
Yes.
I think so, yeah.
And one fun fact, he actually introduced the Securities and Exchange Commission. So a lot of crypto people would be celebrating that. But what he did was, he often took time away to think from first principles about an idea. And so one of the most important things he came up with was Lend Lease, which was an entirely original idea by him. Just one of the big
Lend Lease was where they lent out, like, it was like tanks to, I think, both sides at some point.
Tanks and military equipment to the British.
Okay.
Not for payment, but for, you know, the return at the end.
Got you. Yeah. No, I mean, I haven't read the book, but interesting president, because I think most presidents measure themselves by like the first 100 days, which I think comes from FDR, where like his first 100 days in office. And also, I think if I remember correctly, he was like the first president, I think, where TV was being, it was either TV
radio.
Or radio.
It was radio.
Where they did like the fireside chats or something like that.
And so that ability to just directly communicate with people, you know, I think particularly relevant for crypto, where you had a lot of anonymous teams. And so there was a real difficulty in building credibility and trust. Yep. So I think direct communication, whether it's through podcasts like this, video calls, Twitter spaces, you know, any other means that just like, you know, builds the relationship and trust. I think he was really, you know, pioneering of that.
100%. I mean, if the president of the United States can have like almost like, I think it was daily communication with the populace, then like, yes, so can a founder, because like that can make a difference.
Yeah.
Where can people find out more about you?
So you can find me on Twitter. I am at SyrupSid, syrup like maple syrup. You can also find out more about Maple at Maple Finance on Twitter, and then our website links from there, but it's maple.finance. You can go on there. You can see all of the pools. You can see all of the loans outstanding. So feel free to either contact us via Twitter or there's a contact page on the website.
Amazing. It's been such a pleasure having you on.
Thanks,
and
Felix.
We'll do it again. Have a good one.
Really appreciate it.